Talk Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And today, audibly, it's my old WCW traveling buddy, announcer Dave Penzer. We all used to ride with Dave, me, Chris Benoit, Chavo Guerrero, Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, all the gang, because basically Dave's hotel and car were paid for by WCW because he was an employee. So there you go. On his tab, we used to drive around the nation. We had a great time. Lots of great stories. You're going to hear a bunch of crazy tales coming up. Dave's got so many good ones about drinking with Ric Flair, what it was like on the road with Arn Anderson and Eddie sharing a room, how Dave got the gig as an announcer at WCW in the first place, and Dave was there for the Monday Night Wars and for the bitter end of WCW. So we're going to hear what that was all about, what it was like to be in the thick of all that. Here we go. Enough of my yakking. I now announce Dave Penzer here on Talk is Jericho.
Welcome, everyone, to Talk is Jericho with your host, the Ayatollah of Rock and Roller, Y2J, Chris Jericho, and his guest, me, David Penzer.
I'm here with Dave Penzer, and I can't remember the last time I saw you, maybe, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years
ago? No, a couple WrestleManias ago, before the Hall of Fame, but you probably don't remember.
Okay, yeah.
You were with your family.
But it's weird, though, because we literally live 15 minutes away from each other.
Yeah, right up the road.
And it's been a long time coming, because, like I said, we haven't seen each other a lot, but back, you know, 20 years ago, we were pretty much, you know, traveling partners.
We had some fun.
You know, and that for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, all my WCW years, I think pretty much traveled
with a variety of different people.
Yeah.
Hugh Morris and Bill DeMott. Eddie, of course, bless him, and Chavo and Dean.
What I remember was the first couple loops. And I mean, let's probably just jump right in. But it was, I think, my very first loop when I came in 96. And of course, I was part of the Benoit contingency just by proxy. And I knew Eddie, and I was introduced to Chavo. And I remember that they said, we're going to ride with Penzer, because why did we ride with you?
Because my car was paid for by the company.
Car and maybe even room.
Hotel, too. Yeah.
So it was
Pee-wee was the smartest guy in the whole business.
Pee-wee, Randy
Pee-wee
Anderson.
Took me on, when I first went on the road, Pee-wee took me under his wing, and I'm going to myself, because, you know, I'm green as hell. I'm going to myself, why is this guy being so nice to me? And then, you know, years later, I realized it's because, hell, he got a free room and a free rental car. And we ended up becoming really good friends. But I think we were sort of using each other. I needed somebody to teach me the road and the ropes of the business. And he needed somebody to cover his expenses. So,
and that's what it was. It was Pee-wee, you, and like I said, various lineups, but mostly me, Benoit, Dean, Eddie. There was a loop in there with Arn.
I either travel with Arn or I travel with you guys,
right?
Almost exclusively.
But there was one time, I remember, like, we got a minivan and Arn was in my very first loop. Arn was in that car.
Is that with the one where him and Eddie shared a hotel room?
Yeah. But that's the thing, that we'll get to that story. But the thing that's so funny, like, for me, and now I just travel on my own. But at the time, you know, because WCW, what people don't realize is we worked way more in WCW than we do in WWE. Because I remember it was 22 days a month on the road.
25. It was, we'd do Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night house shows, and Monday night show, Tuesday Thunder, and then every other Wednesday was Saturday night. So if you had a Saturday night, you got home on Thursday morning and you left on Friday morning.
Yeah, I remember it's like 10 days on, 1 day off, 3 days on, 3 days off, or something.
I don't know how I did it. Now you're still doing it, so God bless you.
But I never. Even WWE, they switched early on to 4 days a week.
Yeah.
The only time you would do like those 10 days in a row is if you go to Europe or something like that. But in WCW, when it was hot, it was 10 days in a row with like one or two off, and then, like you said, you'd go back out again.
Yeah.
And it was a tough schedule.
Just came home, washed your clothes.
Yeah.
I didn't even have time to do dry cleaning. I would do dry cleaning on the road from the hotels.
Yeah, you would send it up
from the tux. I didn't even have time on those Saturday night weeks. You know, I had not even 24 hours at home, not even overnight.
So when you send them up to the hotel, would you charge that to
of course,
Turner?
Yeah. That was the good thing about, like we were saying earlier, about being an employee, because I got $35 a day per diem, which back in the day, it doesn't sound like that much money, but it was a decent amount of money.
It still is. It could pay for a couple meals.
And especially like at TV and pay-per-views, I'm not a big morning eater, so I eat catering for lunch. And then I'd use most of my per diem at the bar. And then, you know, we eat like, you know, Waffle House or Whataburger for dinner, which is like $5, you know. And so, you know, most of my per diem was going towards my bar tab.
Drinking, yeah. Yeah, sure. One time, Shane, we were traveling with Shane McMahon when he was on the road, and we went to Waffle House. And he's like, oh, I got this, guys. He went to pay for it with his black diamond card. And of course, the number one rule of Waffle House is cash only. Yeah. And he's like, geez, guys, I got no cash. I'm like, step aside, Junior. Let me show you how Waffle House works. But I remember, so like now, like just now travel by myself when I'm working. But then it was six guys into the minivan. And you have to really, like, it was hard because this guy wants to go to the gym. This guy wants to eat. This guy wants to sleep in. This guy wants to do that. I don't know how we made that work with all six of us.
I there's, you know, a lot of stuff is hazy for me. Mm-hmm. There's certain things that stand out. One memory that just flashed back, we were going to, it was outside of suburban Washington, D.C. I believe it was a college. And I had the music and I had to open the show. So I had to be there on time, especially like an hour early. And I don't even know if you remember this. And you kept making excuses to stop. I need hair product. So you stop. And I'm freaking out in the back seat going, guys, we got to get there. And the more you see me freaking out, the more you're stopping at different places.
Well, you know who orchestrated that?
No, I have
Benoit.
No idea. God bless him, was very quiet. You know, he wasn't an outward ribber, you know, but he was very quiet. I remember somewhere in Michigan, we stole all the Mexicans. They went to a bar with us afterwards. I don't know if you were still there. You might have been gone. And Benoit, Hoovy was driving, and Psychos, all those guys were there. And Benoit, they left their keys on the table at the bar. So Benoit took the keys. Well, they're at the end of the night, they're all, you know, nobody could find their keys. They're all looking through they're all, you know, pretty buzzed. So, you know, everybody's blaming Hoovy because that's sort of what happened. You know, Hoovy was like the me of the Mexican group, got all the heat.
Everyone ganged up on
him. And you know, and Hoovy's getting all upset going, I left him right there and all that. And Benoit finally like planted the keys on a bar stool, like, you know, so nobody would know. Never told anybody. I'm like, are we going to smarten these guys up? And he's like, no. And I'm like, what do you mean no? He's like, we're not going to smarten them up. And I said, well, what's the fun of it? He goes, just watching the action.
Yeah.
And so that was Benoit. He was very quiet about it. But, you know, Kurt Hennig, who's another classic ribber, he would brag about it to everybody, you know. But Benoit was very
And we'll talk more about Chris later on. But that was Chris's thing, because he was saying like, okay, like Ben's just getting nervous. Just keep making excuses to stop. I'm like, all right. And that's why I said, I need hair products. Like the dumbest thing ever. Like, you know, 5:30 for the show. And you were just like, come on, we got to go. We got to get out of here. And you would never see Benoit like laugh. And I go, you never laugh at this. You always go, I'm laughing inside.
Yeah.
And that was kind of his MO for his ribs.
Looking back, I was always an easy mark. I was telling a story the other day. I went to England with Fit Finley. Drew McDonald was on the tour. Worked for Scott Conway and Brian Dixon. It was when I was still getting severance in WCW. And I think Horace Hogan was on the tour too. And they had Dave Taylor was there, Tony St. Clair. It was like the who's who of that whole scene. And the first night they went to eat Indian food, and I hate Indian food, nothing against Indian food, but, and I bitched and I moaned. And so the whole rest of the 4-week tour, every night we went to Indian food. And years later, I didn't even think about it because I was so naive back then, but years later I found out that not only did we go to Indian food every night as a rib on me, but the other guys were getting miserable at the end because most of them hated Indian food, but they were going to make me miserable whether they were miserable at the same time.
Exactly. They were almost ribbing themselves
exactly.
Just to rib you. So. But I remember like also too, when you're talking about having your free room, we would have like three or four or five guys in a room together. And I remember, was it Pee-wee that snored really badly? Or was it you that started?
I do.
What
now.
Were we doing with the remote control? We took the batteries out of the remote control because you and I couldn't sleep when the TV was on. Is that correct? And Eddie always wanted the TV on, so we would take the batteries out of the remote control.
That's the kind of minutia that I don't remember. I remember about the remote control. Right now I snore. I actually just recently got fixed, but not that this matters, but I just recently got fit for, I finally tapped out to the sleep apnea gimmick because my doctor said I could have a heart attack and die. And I'm like, oh, I guess I better wear one of those ridiculous masks to bed. So
maybe it was you that was snoring. We had to put like earplugs in because someone snores so bad. It's either you or Randy Anderson.
Might have been both of us.
Yeah.
I have a snore off.
I remember that was one of those things where you're like, oh, we got a free room. I'm like, dude, I can't sleep in this room anymore. You know, Penzer's snoring way too loud. But let's talk about R. Nettie's room. Remember about that one?
Yeah. We had the next room over. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. Their
like
room was
adjoining rooms.
Their room was right. I don't think it was adjoining.
Oh, okay.
I think it was just we had the next room over so we could hear what was going on because the walls were thin. It was like a Hampton Inn or something. And their room was also right in front of the elevator. So, and then ours was the next one over. The way I remember the story, and of course we were all drinking that night, so we probably have our own fuzzy remembrance. But the way I remember the story is that Arn ordered food. I would say Waffle House. Arn was very unique is that he never ate until he was done drinking.
But that's old school, like Southern wrestlers.
Yeah.
I remember when I first went to Smoky Mountain Wrestling after the show, I was with the Rock and Roll Express and I was like, are we getting something to eat? They're like, something to eat? Pfft. We're getting a case of beer. We're driving to the next town. We eat when we get to town. I'm like, this is going to be 2 a.m. Yeah. But that's how those guys would do it.
Yeah. So Arn never, I mean, until he was done drinking, no matter if it was midnight or 4 a.m., he never ate until he was done. And then he ate and went to sleep.
Yeah.
And so he was getting some kind of food. I want to say Waffle House. It could have been something else.
I think it was Burger King.
Burger King might have been.
That's the reason why.
He asked Eddie if he wanted a he asked Eddie, do you want any food? And then he asked Eddie, you want a piece of some kind of pie? I want to say pecan pie.
I think it was apple pie? Pecan, whatever they serve at Burger King. That's why I know it's Burger King. It comes in that little cardboard piece of pie holder.
And you're a much better storyteller than I am if you want to take this one over.
Well,
but go ahead.
You go ahead and I'll fill in the blanks.
And you just gotta know these two when they're drinking because Arn, you know, and Eddie are two of the, you know, they don't mince words when they're, God bless Eddie, they don't mince words when they're
in
drinking.
Two different ways. Arn, very biting,
sarcastic,
but just hugely insulting. And Eddie would just be very calm and then he would just lose it.
Yeah. So Arn said, Eddie's like, I don't want any pie. And Arn says, don't ask me for any pie. I'm happy to get you a piece of pie, but if you don't get a piece of pie and you want my pie, there's going to be problems here tonight.
In that Southern accent, the way he talks, Eddie, if you want my pie, there's going to be a trouble.
And so, of course, what happened?
Well, Eddie's, of course, super drunk. I come back to the room, and Eddie wants some pie.
And we're listening through the...
we're hearing this, yeah.
I think at one point we actually had our ears to the wall.
And they're arguing. It's like, you know, hey, Arn, you think your shit don't stink, Arn, you don't give me a piece of pie. Eddie, I told you. You wanted a piece of pie? I told you no. So they're arguing back and forth, and finally Arn goes, I don't want the pie. And Eddie goes, and I don't want the... So they threw the pie in the garbage because now they're both so angry at each other out of principle. I'm not going to give you, I'll take the pie. I don't want the pie. I'll give you the pie. I'm not going to eat the pie. And they just threw the damn pie away. The damn thing that no one wanted.
And then the manager knocked on their door and said that there had been noise complaints because they were yelling at each other and said, if I have to come up here again, we're going to kick you out of the hotel. And so we're listening and we could hear the elevator open and the manager got back on the elevator and like everybody was listening in unison from both rooms and the elevator came closed and it dinged and it to go downstairs. And I believe it was Arn goes, or maybe, no, I think it was Eddie goes, all over a piece of effing pie. And then they started yelling at each other again. They didn't get thrown out of the room. The manager never came back. But
I remember I went into the room after. It might have been a different time, but we didn't travel with Arn much. So I think it was the same time. And Arn was asleep on his bed with his shirt off. and his drink, like his soda from the Burger King, balanced on his belly, just perfectly balanced. And I remember seeing the condensation of the moisture dripping down the cup onto his belly, and just like, how does he do that? He's sleeping so still that the damn cup is on his belly, not moving.
I think he could still do that. I don't know. But he doesn't drink anymore.
You travel with all those guys, and sometimes I was there, sometimes I wasn't. Is there other stories that pop into your head about, like, Arn, for example? Because he stopped wrestling very early on to my stay in WCW. So he kind of became management. But when he was actually working, he was like the guy like to hang out with, right?
Arn's one of the funniest guys I've ever met, and yeah. was a very good friend, still is to this day. Just like you, I don't get to see him a lot, but you know, y'all are all over the world. And I'm here in my little nest in Lutz. And for a while, for about a year and a half, we traveled with Flair.
Wow.
Which was fun because Arn and Flair were constantly at each other's throat in a ribbon way.
Beak.
Yeah, yeah.
He calls Flair Beak.
But there was a time, I guess, before I had gotten to WCW that Rick was going through a hard time. He was having a little bit of a breakdown. And Arn got a white van. And that set Flair over the edge. He missed like a week of dates. He flew himself home. He's, I'm the world champion, and you got me a milk truck. I got to pull into Baltimore in a milk truck in a white van. I'm a limousine riding son of a gun, and I got to pull in and he lost it. So the running joke was whenever Arn would go get the car, and whenever Arn could get a white van, he would get a white van and Flair. I mean, at that point, he was in on the joke, so he laughed about it a little bit. But he's like, you could still tell it bothered him. We'd pull in a building. He'd like, look at these people. I'm the world champion, and I'm pulling in a white van, Arn Anderson, you son of a bitch. But and then Flair, I've smartened up to his gimmick very quickly, because we'd go out to the bar, and at the end of the night, he would buy shots of kamikazes.
Right. The whole tray.
Yeah. But what I didn't know, because I'd be like, we'd be like stumbling out, and he'd be like, fine. And I'm like, boy, that guy could drink. What I didn't know at the time, but I found out a little bit later, is that he would give the waitress an extra $50 bill or the bartender to make his kamikazes without any vodka.
Virgin kamikazes, yeah.
So he's whipping kamikazes going, woo, come on, drink with me. And we're all drinking kamikazes that actually had alcohol in it. So
he was also famous for pouring the drink out in the pot. Plant.
Yeah, that was,
you know, you go for the cheers, he pours it down quickly and drinks it, yeah. It's not there, you know.
Well, after that gimmick got exposed, that's when he started paying the waitress extra not to put any in his in his kamikazes. But I wish I could remember more. You know, Rick is famous for, you know, pulling down his pants and doing the dance. My wife one time in Birmingham, England, he did it at the hotel bar, and my lovely wife was sitting right there and got to see it. And not only did she get to see that, but I don't think she ever looked at me the same again.
See, but here's the thing that you have to understand, and people listening that might not kind of know this. It was only, like we said, let's say 20 years ago, 25 years ago, tops. But it was a completely different business.
Oh, totally different world.
You know, totally different world. Explain some of that, because you came in just towards the end of the old style of doing things.
Well, I mean, back then when I first started, the heels and the baby faces didn't really, hang out in the same places,
right,
for sure. Unless it was the dungeon in Atlanta.
Mm.
That was the one place that everybody could get together after.
Was that a Ramada Inn?
Ramada Inn, yeah.
It was a famous, right by the airport. Everyone called it the dungeon.
Yeah, that was the name of the bar. And
what was the name of the waitress that were the lady who ran the place?
Delaine Donovan.
Delaine. Shout out to Delaine Donovan. Everyone knew her, yeah.
She actually still runs it.
Really? It's still there?
Do you remember a couple years ago, Bobby Eaton went missing in Atlanta airport?
Yeah.
Nobody could find him. I got on the phone and called. It's not even the Ramada Inn. It's called, like, it's a different hotel chain. But I called and got Delaine on the phone because I thought maybe he would have gotten in a cab and gone to
hotel.
Yeah, and he didn't. But apparently she's still, it's like a Choice Hotel or something, still running the place.
Jeez.
But
that was the place where all the boys hung out in Atlanta, the dungeon.
That was the famous squeegee story. The Sid Vicious, Brian Pillman, and Mike Graham squeegee story happened there. Harley Race had a zapper. And he'd walk around and zap people. You know, people just maybe like falling over three bar tables.
Like, what do you mean, like one of those cop zappers?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like the guy needed a zapper to like mess with you if he needed
right,
to.
Right, yeah, Harley Race, exactly, yeah.
I remember one time, I was crazy there. I remember one time there, Kevin Sullivan's daughter, Shannon, brought her new boyfriend to the dungeon, and it was Kevin and me and the Nasty Boys. And Kevin was encouraging. This is when I knew I was in a totally different realm. That Kevin was encouraged, because I had young kids. Kevin was encouraging the Nasty Boys to gimmick this guy's drink, Shannon's boyfriend. And Shannon was kind of going along with it. Talk about the devil and the devil, the daughter of the devil. And they ended up knocking him out, shaving both eyebrows. I'll never forget, they put him on the, you know, the luggage cart. They put his passed out body on the luggage cart, brought him up to the room, pushed the luggage cart in the room, didn't even take him off the luggage cart. And then Shannon and us went back down and kept drinking. He woke up the next morning, had no clue what was up, except he had no eyebrows.
And that was the big thing. The Nasty Boys are famous for that. Do you remember the time that they taped? They taped the trainer down. The Steiners and the Nasty Boys taped the trainer stomach first onto the training table, and then started like sodomizing him with like scissors and like products. And he's like, no. I think his name was Danny the Coach.
Danny, yeah. Him and Arn actually are still friends. I still see Danny every once in a while. He married one of the girls that worked in Kristen, one of the girls that worked in PR.
Gotcha.
In WCW, they're still married, and they live in Charlotte. But that wasn't the first time. Actually, early before you came, we were in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it was in the UIC Pavilion was in Chicago. It was in the building where college.
Yeah, it's on the university campus.
Yeah, on the university campus, and our dressing room was the wrestling room. So they had mats all over and different stuff. And they had a rope hanging from the ceiling. And this was a different trainer. This wasn't Danny the trainer. This, I think, Chuck was his name, or
Chuck,
Charles.
Yeah.
But they taped him. No, it wasn't even him. It was Chris Sullivan, who was an enhancement guy that I used to bring up. But he like looked for heat. He's like got off on the attention of being, you know, of all the big stars, you know, giving him a hard time. They taped him to the rope that was hanging down. And he's just hanging there, you know, going back and forth. They taped him to the rope and they said, the person who lets him down, they're going back up. And Chris Sullivan was on the rope for at least an hour until Janie Engel, of course, was the one who had to come get him down, because Janie's the only one that knew that the Steiner brothers weren't going to do anything to her. So
Janie was like high up in the office. Yeah, like more like the big lady in the office.
So she had been back from the Crockett days. So, you know, she had as much respect as anybody probably in that locker room did.
How was it for you kind of talking about WCW at the time when it was the number one promotion in the world? What year did you start there?
I started bringing guys up in 91.
Bringing guys up? You're booking guys?
Yeah. When I broke in the business, I broke in under a guy named Bob Roop.
Yeah.
And there was a place called Global Wrestling Alliance in South Florida.
Okay.
And when they closed down, which it was like a penny stock deal. And when they closed down, me and Bob bought the ring and started doing indie shows, because I was, you know, trying to find a way to get in the wrestling business. And so Bob was tight with Ole Anderson. So when Ole got the book at WCW and Turner took over, he brought Bob up as an agent. And Bob, to his credit, and I saw him about 6 months ago and gave him a big hug. He took care of me. And back then, Jody Hamilton, the assassin, was booking the enhancement guys. And what I didn't know is every territory had an enhancement booker, so that Jody didn't have to deal with 50 guys or 40 guys. He had the Italian Stallion and George South in the Carolinas. He had Rip Rogers in Ohio area. He had Mike Jackson in Alabama. And he didn't have anybody at the time, I guess, in Florida. And he needed somebody. So my deal was WCW would rent me a van. They didn't pay me any money. Each week I would find five enhancement guys, and they had to be good, or else, you know, if they weren't good, I heard about it. And we would drive. I'd start in Fort Lauderdale, drive across Alligator Alley, up I-75, across I-4, and picking people up along the way, up to usually suburban Atlanta, Marietta, Gainesville, one of those places. And then we'd drive back, and when they started doing double shots, that was great because we actually got to stay over. But each guy had to pay me $25. That was the deal that the bookers got.
Booking fee.
So WCW didn't pay me until I started ring announcing, which was 2 years of driving all over the country basically with these enhancement guys before I got an opportunity to to be the ring announcer, to try out to be the ring announcer. And so then I became the backup ring announcer. That was about 90, the end of 93. And then by 95, Gary Capetta had left. Mm-hmm. And that was right around when Nitro was starting. So they just handed me the ball and I ran with it.
Took over. Yeah, right away.
Well, I wasn't going to let, that's why I worked so many days, because I wasn't going to let anybody else, you know, be a ring announcer.
Were you the only announcer in WWE?
For the longest time, until about, when I started doing talent relations and booking at the very, very end of WCW, after you had left, we hired a guy to do Saturday night. But it was up to me to hire the guy, and I made sure to hire a guy that was good enough to be a ring announcer, but that I didn't think it was going to be. I don't know that I've ever admitted this before. Maybe the face to face thing Yeah. That was good enough to do a good job, but was never going to be,
better than you.
Knock on wood, never going to be able to take my spot. So, and then I got like a one weekend off a month. So I finally took some time off because I was getting burned out. But yeah, for like for the WCW Monday Night Wars, for that main period, it was me. That was all. Why give somebody else an opportunity to take your gig?
You're doing all 3 hours out there the whole time.
Yeah.
Just quickly, tell me about Wildcat Willie.
I know Eric has a podcast too, and with Conrad. I actually hosted a panel with Eric at Starcast, but I never did ask him about Wildcat Willie. I don't know whose idea that was.
It was the mascot.
Yeah, the mascot. They spent, the first costume cost more than I got paid in a year, which was like, it cost like 70 grand. Back then, I didn't make 70 grand. Yeah. I was an employee. So I got benefits. I eventually did eclipse 70 grand, knock on wood. But then Wildcat Willie got a new costume, which looked even more like a rat. I couldn't even figure it out. That cost like $120,000. You remember Andre, right?
Yeah.
I think he's still hanging around WWE, isn't he?
I haven't seen him. Andre was a guy who made costumes. He made the whole
Glacier thing.
Glacier and all that stuff. But he ripped them off.
Oh, the guy made millions, I think.
Yeah, but he would make a costume, like you said, like a Wildcat Willie, whatever it was supposed to be. It looked like a rat. Was it supposed to be like a wildcat, I guess. Like a tiger or something. And he charged him $120,000 for a costume that you could get at Party City.
Well, I don't know about Party City, but
it was very intricate stuff.
It was years he did this. I mean, for the Glacier stuff and the, you know, and then he was involved in the Sting, you know, the fake Sting,
right,
Jeff Farmer and all that. And he just made, I mean, talk about a guy, you know, they talk about guys who made ridiculous money in WCW and, you know, the Hulks and the Goldbergs and those guys did. Andre actually might have outdone them all.
You know who's still working in WWE is Ellis. Ellis, the stunt guy?
I heard that. Is Andre still around?
No, I haven't seen Andre in years. He might have come in WWE very quickly, but I don't recall.
Well, they finally, they're smart enough to see his
Wildcat
game.
Willie, the guy who played him, was like drunk half the time.
He used to be a male cheerleader at on a college campus, and I guess the gimmick was to attract kids.
Yeah.
So before he had his own little entrance music, and before he went on the road to the freaking house shows talking about wasting money. And all he did, I'd say, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Wildcat Willie. His music would hit. They'd set up a little mini trampoline, and he'd come around. He'd shake hands with the little kids. He'd do a flip off the trampoline. Then he'd go keep drinking. And I think he was making more money than I was at the time. Everybody made more money than I did. DJ Rand made more money than I did for being a DJ.
The best part was when they put the Steiners put thumbtacks in Wildcat Willie's boots one time. He was flipping. He's like, ow! Who's DJ Rand?
He's still around. I'm friends with him on Facebook. You weren't there.
Yeah.
Towards the last couple of years, they brought him in on Nitro and Thunder, and he would DJ before the shows, and then we would interact during the commercial breaks. And, you know, I'd say, DJ Rand, what'd you think of the match? And he'd do a little rap, and then he'd play a little, you know, DJ Man, you know, Rand, play us a song, and he'd play something to keep the audience involved.
They always have that, because that's what the Nitro girls did for a while. You know, and they had DJ Ran, and they had Wildcat Willie.
Well, I get the Nitro girls. I even get DJ Ran, you know, having a party DJ, because that was the thing back then, you know. But I still don't get Wildcat Willie.
So how was it?
I saw something on Twitter today where they showed a picture of the Giant and Ron Reese dressed up as the mummy.
Oh, yeah.
The Yeti, where they were both bear hugging Hogan. And he, Eric Bischoff on Twitter put a picture and said, I'm never going to live this down.
Yeah.
And I think to a lesser extent, he needs to answer for Wildcat Willie.
So how was it when you saw the company just explode after NWO and all that sort of thing?
It went so fast. You know, it was such a fast ride that I don't know that I got to enjoy it as much as I could have. But, I mean, you know, we were and we were playing hard. You know, we were living hard, playing hard, and you know, traveling hard. So I couldn't do it now. I look back inside. I don't know. You know, Fit Finley, God bless him. You know more than I do. Still on the road with WCW. You know, WWE. He, you know, one Monday he's in Los Angeles, and then he's in Taipei, and then he's in Finland, and you know, it's like you can't even follow him. And I just don't know how he does it. But yeah, we were running hard. And back in the day, I tell my kids now who are 21 and 23, I say enjoy it while you can, because when you get older, it's hard. Probably be the better one to answer. You're still doing it not only with wrestling but with a rock and roll band. God
well,
bless
the
you.
Thing is, like I said, like with WCW, I mean, like when we talk about how things have changed, like now guys all stay in different places and this, but in WCW, everyone stayed at the same hotel, and all the fans knew it, and everybody knew it. So there was like a party after the shows pretty much every night.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because, you know, everyone was in the same place.
Yeah, the not only the wrestlers but the production people.
Production,
so, you know, everybody became friends, everybody, you know, so it was a party every night, and if there wasn't a party, we'd find a party.
You remember this talking about Philadelphia, the airport Philadelphia hotel, when everyone was in the bar?
I was thinking about this the other day. I have a strange thought. Was JBL in that bar?
Yes, he was. I believe he was in the bar because I think WWE was like in the same area.
Yeah.
Or something.
Because I remember JBL gave me a hard time over something. I don't remember what it was. And Fit had to step in and say, hey, he's cool. Leave him alone.
I think that was about 98 or something like that.
Yeah, it was towards the end of before you left me.
Yeah. Yeah, but we were in the bar. Those guys were in there. And somehow, what did you do to make me and Benoit mad?
Oh, God, I don't know.
You were always doing stuff.
My usual hijinks.
Yeah.
But only next thing I remember is that you said hockey fight and it was on.
Yeah.
And next thing I know, my yellow sweater. You guys had my yellow sweater.
I think what I remember from this is it's like, Penzer, you've got like a minute to get out of here. And you wouldn't leave.
I wasn't going anywhere.
It was like 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We're going to get. And you ran out the bar. And we ran out following you. And we tackled you in the bar.
That sounds right.
And we took off all your clothes.
Yeah, pretty much.
And Benoit basically stripped you down. And you had to run to the elevator, I think just with your underwear on.
Yeah, that's true.
This is in the lobby of the Hilton Airport in Philadelphia. It's a nice place. And we just, like savages, just stripped you down.
But the moral of the story is like a couple of months later, I'll never forget it. My mother said, we were living in Atlanta. My mother said, you got to go see Les Miserables. And so she bought us tickets to go see Les Miserables in Marietta. We lived all the way in Peachtree City. So it's like an hour each way. And I was bored stiff. I actually brought this up to my wife the other day. She was like, oh, it was such a good show. And I'm like, I was bored stiff. So we're driving home and we called the babysitter, who's a family friend's daughter. And she said, I said, you know, we said everything all right with the kids. And she's like, yeah, but you were on Access Hollywood.
Hard copy or something.
Or something hard copy. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit stripped you in a hotel to your tidy whitey underwear. And I'm automatically thinking, I'm fired.
Oh my God.
So I spent the whole weekend worrying about it. You know, and back then, you know, but you know, now there's texting. Texting wasn't big back then, or else I had to text everybody.
Even cell phones.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember first thing Monday morning, I called Alan Sharp. And I said, PR guy, head of PR. And I said, Alan, I saw the thing on hard copy. I'm so sorry. We were just a bunch of guys messing around. It was a hockey fight. Please tell me I'm not fired. He laughed so hard. He said, we were told it was going to be an expose on all the crazy things the wrestlers did. And we were thinking a lot worse than you getting stripped down to your underwear in a hotel and a meaningless, you know, kind of joking around thing. He said, you took one for the team. Don't think twice about it. And I was like, thank God.
Yeah, what had happened was somebody had snuck into the bar and had like a camera in like a duffel.
I think they used the security footage.
Well, no, somebody actually had a camera too, because remember they showed like Beefcake in the bar with like a tray of shots, like Flair with a tray, like the wrestlers were drinking all night long, and it's Flair with a tray of shots. It's like, that happens every night. And then wrestlers, and a wild melee ensues where two turn on their own or something. But somebody was, there was security cameras, but somebody was filming, like they went in there specifically to get the behind the scenes story. Cause I was the same. It's like, oh, you guys are involved in this. And I was like, that's all that they got? Like,
yeah.
Now, how about the other time in the Target Center when you thought you were gonna get fired?
I've been waiting years to talk to you about this story.
Yes.
So, it was just me and you on that loop, and we showed up really early at the Target Center. For some reason, it was really early. And it was a house show, so nobody of consequence has ever showed up at the house shows, the road agent and the whoever was the work for Zane Breslov that night, and to do the house. And we're somehow the subject of you never signing. At this point, you had been in WCW for a little while, and you had never signed a contract.
17 months.
Is it 17 months?
I was working there 17 months. We started for that.
And this is during the Monday Night Wars.
Yes.
This is,
and I was,
you know, Luger's going one way, and you know, it's going.
Yeah. I was a cruiserweight champion, maybe even TV title, whatever.
Yeah, I think you were. Yeah. So we're walking in, bags over our, you know, I have my suitcase in my hand, my bag, and you had your bag. We're walking in through the indoor parking of the Target Center, and I'll never forget, I said, you could show up on Raw tomorrow. And you said, oh, you know what? I can. And we were just, we kept talking about that. And we looked around the corner. We're like the first people in the frickin' building. I still don't understand how this happened. Eric Bischoff, the president of the frickin' company, was on the payphone. And he just looked at us like, hello, boys. And I just remember me and you went in the dressing room and said, we're fired.
Because it was a little bit more stiff than that. I remember you saying, like, I could go to Raw tomorrow. Bischoff, it's his fault for not signing me, something like that.
It was
happened.
Pretty yeah, it was pretty.
I remember walking around the corner, it's one of those things where, like, we're in the movies, like, you go, that guy, he's standing right behind me, isn't he? He wasn't standing behind us, he was right in front of us.
That's like
the
only house show he ever went to.
I don't know why he was there, I don't know what he was doing, and the thing is, he never said anything about it.
Well, he did to me.
What did he say?
Well, because I was dumb enough to sell it, like we, you know, like we started this whole discussion about me selling everything.
Right.
So, but people make it worse. I was dumb enough to. You didn't sell it. You just thought you were getting fired, and you were probably thinking
I just ignored
of
it. Yeah.
Yeah, where you were going to go. I really didn't have anything else. You know, you could have gone back to Japan, Mexico, you know. So I'm sure, you know, while you weren't thrilled that the whole thing happened, in your mind, you're probably thinking, all right, I got to make a couple phone calls.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, what am I going to do to feed my freaking family? And so I went to Eric and I said, Eric, I'm really sorry. We were just talking about hypotheticals. You know, I'm a company guy. And he goes, get the hell out of my dressing room and see me at the end of the show. And so the entire show, I thought I was, I mean, I tried to talk to him during intermission because I'm having like major anxiety attacks. I tried to talk to him dinner. Don't talk to me till the end of the show. Finally, at the end of the show, he called me in and he said, I want you to know that I've just been busting your chops, but I really was pissed off. Don't ever talk about stuff like that again or else you will be fired.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that he heard all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And he said, I'm just messing with you, but.
Wow.
I'm not messing. You know, I'm kind of like, this is your warning, you know.
Oh, gosh.
So.
That's crazy, huh? What was your relationship with Bischoff as a boss?
He walked by me with his head down. It's actually, you know, it's been a little, it's funny. I had him on my podcast and we did it like I said, I hosted a couple of panels with him at StarCast. And it's actually been a little bit cathartic, you know, to have a cocktail with him and all that, because he was very intimidating guy back in the day. And you know, I loved my job and didn't really have a plan B. That was my plan. You know, this was my plan A, B, C, and D. I'm living my dream. I'm paying my bills, making decent money. And so I tried kind of like to stay away. And, you know, he's not the kind of guy who would walk up to you, put his arm around. Hey, David, how you doing today? Thanks for all the hard work you do. I'll never forget one time I was promised a pretty big raise. And Nick Lambros, son of a bitch, Nick Lambros, who's a vice lawyer, but he was the vice president at the time, he turned down my raise. And I mean, the company wasn't in any trouble. He was just being a jerk. And I can remember Craig Leathers was my immediate boss. And I can remember I said to Craig, let me just meet with Nick. I could explain. And he's like, you sure you want to do that? And I said, yes, I want to do. He's like, I don't think you should do that. He's pretty good. So I went in and I stated my case about, you know, pretty much saying I was promised this raise. And, you know, basically what happened is I came in lowball because they were giving me a test. And they said, if you pass the test, this is what you'll go up to. And I said, I'm not asking for Mean Gene money. I'm not asking for Bobby Heenan money. I'm not asking for, you know, Tony Schiavone money. I'm just asking for what you were promised me. And he looked up to the table. He goes, and it's a good thing because you're no Mean Gene. Now get the hell out of my office. And so Craig said, do you want to go to me to go to Eric? And I said, yeah, what do I got to lose? Right. Eric will say, no, you don't have your raise. I'm not going anywhere. And they don't know that. But, you know, I didn't threaten to quit or anything. And I never forget, I was in a dressing room, in the announcer's dressing room at one of the night shows. And Eric walked in and said, I took care of your raise. Thank you. You work hard. And he walked out. And Tony Schiavone, who was in the locker room, turned to me and said, that is the best compliment Eric Bischoff could give you. You know, he's not the kind of guy that's going to say, hey, you're a great employee, but he respects people that work hard. Mm-hmm. So that was about the only positive interplay I ever
How
had.
How was your interaction? Like, I'm thinking, okay, so there's the talent and the wrestling side. Then there's kind of ring announcer, commentator. How was your relationship with those guys, like with Mean Gene and Bobby Heenan and those type of, like, Heenan was freaking hilarious.
Oh, it was awesome. I was, you know, very good friends with all of them. Tony was my boss.
Tony was your boss.
He was my boss, and then he reported to Craig Leathers.
Gotcha.
And I had worked in production at a time before I always wanted to do stuff behind the scenes because, you know, you never could do
That's
enough
the
things.
Future, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, you might laugh at this, but to this day, I'm convinced that if WCW were still in business right now, all this time, I'd be like a VP or something. I'm convinced
sure you
of
would
it.
Be.
But
it's not. That's how it works.
You know. But yeah, Tony and Mike Tenay and Lee Marshall and Bob, we had a dressing room, and then at one point they got us a trailer because the dressing room, just everybody had a dressing room.
You needed dressing rooms for everybody.
Yeah.
NWO had one. Yeah. Macho Man had one. Hogan had one.
Ultimate Warrior had one. Piper had one. Yeah.
And then like 75 guys stuck in a, you know, in one team dressing room, like a Cambodian refugee camp.
But yeah, so they gave us a trailer, and so we would just sit around the dressing room of the trailer, and Gene would tell stories, and Bobby was, you know, bless Bobby. I had Nick Aldis on my podcast, cheap plug, as Mick Foley would say. Yeah. And he was talking about how much he respected Bobby Heenan. And I said, it's a shame you never got to know him. He was the funniest guy in the world. And he said, yeah, it's one of my biggest regrets is that I never got to know him. And I said, I normally wouldn't say this to somebody, but it should be one of your biggest regrets. Mm-hmm. That's how talented and funny that guy actually really was all the time. And so he would hold court and, you know, he'd make fun of Lee Marshall. That to see the good thing is I was so low on the totem pole in the announcer's room that nobody would rib me, so they'd all rib Lee Marshall.
He was pretty good though for what he did.
Lee,
yeah,
great voice, good.
He taught me a lot about promos. He always had a little book with a little factoid about every city that we were going to talk about in the box where you do interviews.
Yeah, and I produced those. I don't know if you remember.
That's right.
I actually did them towards the end. I actually hosted them. They ran out of people there.
Well, that's how I got a break in there. Was that Luger didn't show up because he went to the tanning salon or something. And I used to hang out in the back. I think you might have even at some point said, hey, you should hang out in the back in the box. Because, you know, learn some promos. Because what they would do is they would have a localized promo. We're coming to Fort Wayne. We're coming to Sarasota. And they would have Arn doing them, Flair, Sting, whatever. And I sat in the back and watched. And then one day when Luger didn't show up, I got to do one.
Yeah.
And then the next day I got to do like two. And that's how I started learning.
Well, as the talent got more and more full of themselves, so to speak, right. You know, and everybody was kind of full of themselves. I was even little old me was full of myself by the end.
Yeah.
But as the talent got more and more full of themselves, it got harder to get them to come in the box. So the guys like you, like Conan, people like that wanted to hone their crafts and promos, and Conan was already a good promo, and you were always good, but would come in. That's who we would rely on. it.
Like you said, honed your craft. Yeah. I learned so much.
Chavo was always in there. What could I, you know, what could I do?
Working with Gene, working with Lee Marshall. I mean, that's how you learn.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was and a great
experience. We did probably 100 of them in one day, you know, because that was back in syndicated television. And so, you know, they turned on your TV and you're watching in your town. So we want to tell you we're coming to your town. So, hey, El Paso, we're coming to your town. And, you know, me and Gene, you know, want to say hello to my close personal friend. And
make sure you go to Chico's Tacos in El Paso and let's talk to Chavo Guerrero. But I mean, that talk about a lost of something that's changed, they don't do that anymore in WWE. Nothing.
Well, there's no reason to, really, because there's
still house shows, though. I guess there's no syndicated TV.
There's no syndicated TV. Yeah. I guess you could do them for like Facebook or something.
Yeah,
like
you could,
that.
And they probably should, because it's a good way to learn.
It probably
you
is.
Know? I remember just the genius of Gene Okerlund.
He was the best.
He just leads you through it. If you didn't have a clue what you were doing, he would lead you through it.
He could do a promo with a cardboard cutout and make it entertaining. And I'm not saying that is...
Oh, but he had to a lot of times with guys that had less personality than a cardboard cutout. Because remember, like WCW had so many guys in that locker room. Because all the house shows would be Mexicans, me and Dean, Chris Adams versus Bobby Blaze, and then like one NWO match, and that'd be it. The Steiners versus somebody, and that'd be about it.
Ming and Barbarian.
Yeah. But actually, when I started getting some steam and turn heel, it was on you.
That was, I tell people, that was, correct me if I'm wrong, that was about 85% your idea. I think I had a little bit, about 10% input, and Terry Taylor had about 5% input, because Terry was the...
It was Terry's initial idea.
Idea?
I wasn't pitching ideas at the time. I just wanted to do
something.
Well, but
I thought you were, though, because that was like WCW Saturday Night, where nobody cared anymore.
The first time was on Thunder, though, dude. It was one of the first times on Thunder. I lost the match. I have a tantrum, and then he said, go attack Dave Penzer and rip his shirt, his jacket off. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, just do it. And that's kind of how it started. And then I did it 3 or 4 times, I think. And then I tried to apologize and then ripped it off again. It was kind of
my chair. You'd take my chair and you'd bang it again. That was actually the funny part. Because you always, not to kiss your ass while I'm sitting in your house doing your podcast, but you're always so creative. It amazes me, you know, how you could recreate yourself and the list thing. I'm a big mark for that. And the thing with you and Kevin Owens. And I remember texting back and forth with you when you came back and didn't say a word,
right.
And which was like brilliant. So you're always really good at being able to do these characters, and the brilliance of it wasn't the tux jacket. That was the heat. The little bit of comedy, levity was you take the chair and you smash it against the ring post so I wouldn't have a chair. But then the next week, not only would you come out with a brand new tux jacket, but you'd come out with a brand new chair. Like you're bringing me a chair. Like there ain't 40,000 chairs in the freaking arena. But you're bringing me the chair. And that, you know, that people still remember me for that. I mean, you know, I'm not, 20 years later, people still remember me for that.
Because you were part of an angle.
Yeah, of course.
And it was a very integral part. Like that's basically how people knew that Jericho is not this nameless, faceless babyface. He's now this crybaby heel, which was a start. And it was because of what we had done together. I remember even one point, maybe it was just your fantasy, but they were thinking about, or you thought it'd be a good idea to do a
no action. You son of a no, no they were gonna bitch. Do it
there, it was they were your fantasy you made it up.
No, they were gonna do it.
What are they gonna do?
It was back in the day where they had the I don't want to say dolls,
action figures,
and they had like an accessory in it. So like Ravens would have a chair.
Yeah,
I remember for whatever reason the Giants had a little Rey Mysterio for whatever reason. So the Chris Jericho one was going to have a David Penzer ring announcer with a removable jacket and chair. And you and like they pitched it and they were going to do it. And I was like, I went home and said, hey, kids, you know, Jeff's all puffed out by the little 5'6" frame going, guess who's going to have their own action figure? You can take it to school and show all your friends. 2 weeks later, oh, see you later. I'm going to WWE. And that was the end of that. No, that was not a figment of my imagination. They were going to actually do that. But
was it hard when kind of all your guys went to WWE? Because I left. Then pretty soon after Dean and Eddie and Perry and Chris left, Mysterio left.
I remember that night. I begged those guys not to go, but they made the right decision in hindsight.
Why did you beg them not to go?
Because I was sort of in the middle of that because I was friendly with Kevin Sullivan, and Kevin was trying to prove to Chris and Eddie and those guys that he would give them an honest, fair shot, even though there was personal animosity and a history of, you know, not using those guys, including you, in a way that was a main event way. So Chris, knowing that I'm friends with him, and I would, you know, sort of trust, not Chris, Kevin, I sort of trusted Kevin, but that these guys sort of trusted me, sort of made me, I don't want to say a middle guy, but sort of made me a middle guy to say, you got to explain to these guys. I gave them the world title. I'm taking this seriously. And so I tried to explain that to them, and their minds were made up. They weren't hearing any of it. And in hindsight, it was the better move anyways. I mean, look what happened a year or so later, and the whole thing went up in flames. So, but yeah, I remember that night. I can remember exactly where, I don't remember the building, of course, but I can remember exactly where I was standing when I was begging those guys not to leave. But I had Arn. So it was basically towards the end, it was me and Arn, and Charles Robinson was the designated driver. And bless him, he's still in the business all these years later. And Danny, the trainer, and that was sort of the what was left. That was, you know, that was left of the guys that I hung out with, and so that was the last year. That's who we traveled with.
Did you know that things were going to end? Was it a surprise when it finally happened?
It was well, you know, because I knew things were going bad, but you want to think the best. You in your head, you want to say, you know, they're not going to throw away this whole thing. You know, it's been so successful. Obviously, it's not now, but or somebody's going to buy it, or, you know, and Eric was trying to buy it at the time. So, you know, leading up to it, I would get little hints from Craig Leathers, who I'd become friendly with, who's, like I said, was my boss. And he would say, you know, I just had a meeting with Brad Siegel. It's not looking good. But I'd always try to see the positive, because the negative was too, there was, what was I going to do? You know, like I said, there was never a plan B. So I'll never forget when they finally sold, and somebody called me and said, turn on the computer, and turned on the computer in my house in Peachtree City. It was to the right of my kitchen on a little table. And it had I've told this story before, it had the WWE logo on the splash page at WCW.com, purchases right in the middle, and then it had the WCW logo. And my heart sank. I actually think I might have cried, not sobbed, but I think a tear came down my eye. And you know, I just decided that, you know, and they didn't give us much time either. You know, it's like the next Monday, they're going to come take the company from you. And I was on the fast track back then because Eric was going to be the boss if he bought the company. John Laurinaitis was going to be his, you know, second in command. And I was supposed to be John Laurinaitis' personal assistant.
You were getting into talent relations.
Yeah, talent relations and the booking committee. So I had gained the trust of John Laurinaitis, and Eric and John had gained Eric's trust. And that was about the only trust that Eric had at that point was John Laurinaitis. I mean, it was explicitly told to me that, you know, wherever, when Eric buys it, you're going to move out to wherever the offices are, and you're going to work directly for me. And, you know, so I didn't want to let that go, but it went away. And so I just decided that last Nitro, I knew that Shane was going to be there.
Panama City.
Yeah, Panama City. I just decided I was going to go all out and just do the best job I could and get the crowd as hot as possible. And it was sort of like my tryout in front of Shane. I didn't realize that Bruce and Jerry Briscoe were there too. I did see them, but I didn't realize at the time what they did because we lived in such a bubble.
Right.
But I'll never forget. I came back after the show was over, and Shane was in the gorilla position. He had just gotten off the ring making his big announcement. He looked at me and he said, "Hey, you do a really good job out there. Thank you very much." So there was a glimmer of hope, you know, at that time that, that, you know, something might happen. And then it's funny because they did that first match in Seattle.
Yeah,
with Buff Tacoma, Bagwell against Tacoma, Buff against Booker T. And apparently Johnny Ace had called me later that day and said, "Penzo, you should have been in Tacoma." And I'm like,
"You should have told me.
I could get on an airplane now. I don't know if I can get there in time." "Why?" He said, "Because somebody asked Vince during the production meeting who should ring announce that match." And Vince's response was, "Well, who's the WCW ring announcer?" And somebody said, "David Penzo." They said, "Is David Penzo here?" And they said, "No." So they decided to have Stacy Keibler do it. Mm. If somebody would have thought to have me there, I mean, you know, but then the next week we were in Atlanta where I lived and he said, come by, I'll tell him you're there. But by then they had already watered it down to ECW. And
well, because that night Vince decided against it. Because it was going to be, as you know, a whole separate promotion.
Yeah.
What SmackDown is was supposed to be WCW.
No, I met with Jim Ross in a hotel in downtown Atlanta. Everybody did. All employees got to meet Jim Ross and John Laurinaitis. And Jim Ross said to me, we're planning on running this as a separate brand and we are planning for you to be that brand's ring announcer. Mm. And so I understand you have severance pay. Go enjoy your severance pay. We'll get back to you when we're a little bit more ready to go. And, you know, then I saw the match in Tacoma, and then John Laurinaitis called me. Then I came to Atlanta the next week, and then Laurinaitis came out and said, yeah, they moved in a different direction, so we don't need you. But you could stay and watch. And I'm like, no, I'm going to go home.
Yeah, I've seen enough wrestling over the years, right?
So I went home, and I did actually get a call. I don't know if you know this, actually. I was very close to a job being a live event host. Mm. And I got flown first class to New York. They picked me up in a limo.
First class?
Yeah. Jeez. They picked me up in a limo, took me to Connecticut to stay at the Holiday Inn across from Titan Towers, met with everybody the next day but Vince. I mean, Ed Cohen, John Laurinaitis, Big John Gaborik, I mean, Jim Ross, pretty much everybody there is to meet with. And they had me pitch an idea where I would come out and do different contests and you know, not be the ring announcer, but be the host.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was an idea that Vince had. And basically when I left, they said, it was right before Christmas, and they said, you got the job, but we don't know if it's going to be. I had my tattoo company, so I was like trying to pull myself in 42 directions, but I wasn't going to not go to WWE if I had the chance, WWF at the time. So they said, we have the job, but we don't know if you're going to be an employee, like a salary, or if you're going to be per show. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, whatever, it doesn't matter. I'm going on a cruise for Christmas. It was my parents' wedding anniversary, 20th wedding anniversary. I'm going on a cruise. And she said, call us back when you get in the new year. And so I'm thinking I had a job, and she called me back. I called back, and she said Vince decided to move in a different direction. And that's when they put Eric and Teddy Long, who were the general managers, on the road. I guess Vince had decided if he was going to spend airfare and money to have somebody host, he would put people that were already, you know.
And he did have paid, like, the Divas do it for a time. You know, he did kind of have that, you know.
But
let's talk a little bit about Peachtree City and about Benoit. Because you lived out there with him, and it was you and Fit, and Chris was out there, and Regal. It was kind of the Peachtree
City.
Dave Taylor.
Johnny Grunge. And Darwin, who was a cameraman who, when I mentioned the babysitter, was the daughter of a family friend. That was Darwin and Jill's daughter. Jill's still one of my wife's best friends to this day. We all hung out. It was a fun place, and we all hung out, but we got to see a side of Chris.
I don't want to get into the whole specifics, but that's what I want to talk about. Because you mentioned earlier, like, and this is why I wanted to talk to you about it, because you were one of the guys that was really close to him, as I was. And, you know, as crazy and as diabolical as the last weekend of his life was, he was pretty much a pretty cool, reliable, good guy. But there was chinks in the armor that started happening. And I wanted to kind of just hear your thoughts on that.
Well, this is the way I see it. Chris was a very private person, as you know.
Yes.
And so very shy, very private, didn't want anybody to know, you know, if there was anything bad going on in his life. I remember when he left his wife, Marta, I don't think anybody knew about it for like 6 months.
Right.
And just one day he said, oh yeah, like 6 months ago we split up.
Yeah.
And so he was intensely private, but because Johnny Grunge was kind of a God bless him, kind of a screw up, and Nancy knew him really well from ECW, and Benoit became friendly with him too. They trusted Johnny Grunge.
Like the middle ground.
He was the only guy that they felt comfortable, and they had a fight. You know, Nancy would go and stay with Grunge, and then Chris would come.
Wow.
But Grunge, you know, they thought they probably that they could trust him, but Grunge would tell me. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so we'd talk, and then it wasn't just about that. We'd talk about a lot of things, but then he'd say, oh, Chris and Nancy, and had another, you know, and it's bad. And so that and a couple of other small things that, were odd throughout the time that we socialized with them. And then he had later, he had pulled back and stopped socializing with the whole group completely. And this is WCW time. This isn't even WWE. It just, and I honestly think that if Johnny Grunge was still alive, so would be those three.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's the only reason, but they lost their only person they felt comfortable. You know, that whatever happened that horrible weekend, I'm convinced that Nancy would have ran out on that Friday and gone to Johnny Grunge and had a few drinks, and it would all been resolved by, and Chris would have been on a plane to go to wherever in Texas to be at that pay-per-view. There's not a doubt in my mind. But I will tell you this, and I think I told you this at the time when I heard what happened, I wasn't surprised.
Mm-hmm. That's what Regal said that as well. And you weren't surprised because of...
I just saw odd things that all added up as soon as I heard what had happened.
Yeah.
My son woke me up. I was taking a nap and said about 6 o'clock at night, I was taking an afternoon nap and said, "Dad, I just heard that Chris and Nancy and Daniel are dead." Mm-hmm. My first, you know, you wake up and you're groggy. My first thought was, "Are you kidding?" And he said, "No." And my second thought was, and I don't know what, I was like, "Oh my God, I hope Nancy killed Daniel and that's why Chris killed Nancy." I mean, that was my first thought. It wasn't like, "Oh, I wonder what happened."
Right.
And not that I didn't like Nancy. She was, you know, a wonderful person, but I didn't want to think that my friend was capable of doing something like that. And so, you know, I guess in my perverse way, maybe if Nancy had done it accidentally and then Chris flipped out, I don't know, but that was my first thought. I do remember talking to you for a long time on the phone with you trying to process this and having a hard time believing that I wasn't surprised.
Well, all of us were that, because talking with Chavo and talking with Regal, talking with Vince, no one saw it coming. But when you know kind of the deep down, like, you know, I remember one time Benoit gave me so much GHB that I was throwing up in the sumo arena on the floor, just puking everywhere at the Super J Cup 1995. And he was standing there with a New Japan official staring at me laughing. "Look at this guy, what a piece of shit." And I'm like, and he just thought that was the funniest thing. But that's Chris Benoit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He thought that was funny. So, you know, and like you said, there were a lot of indications that weird stuff happened. But still to this day, man, it's one of those things where you're like, wow, I can't believe it, you know?
Well, to this day, what haunts me is that Daniel somehow got caught up in that, however it happened. Nobody was there. But, you know,
but I agree with, because I think too, Eddie died, Ray Traylor died, Black Cat died, Victor Marr.
Well, there Johnny was a Grunge lot of died. Extenuating circumstances. But
I remember when Traylor died, Big Boss Man, Chris called me crying, said, "I can't take it. I can't take any more of my friends dying." And then Grunge, who I think was kind of that middle ground for them.
Yeah. He was the only one they trusted, both of them. You know, like I think Chris trusted a couple other people, and Nancy definitely trusted people, but that's the only one they both trusted.
He was the shade
because
of gray.
He didn't look at them in a negative way, you know, because he was, you know, "Look, I'm Johnny Grunge. Who am I to judge?" You know?
That's right.
And I'm not saying that in a negative way towards Grunge. Grunge was a great guy, but, you know, Grunge was, you know, if not for Ted Petty keeping him on the straight and narrow, you know.
That's the truth.
So, and then Ted passed. So it's crazy what happened. But yeah, the part about Daniel still haunts me, because there's every bit of me that believes that Chris could have done that to Nancy, unfortunately, and snapped. But
all of us can see that. You know what I mean? Like snapping.
Well, I know somebody who just recently in this very town that we live in snapped over a relationship and ended up getting chased by the police and driving head on to the other side and died in a crash just this past weekend. It was on live PD of all places.
Wow.
And same sort of scenario, but his kid wasn't in the car.
Well, that's what I mean. It's the kid that you can't understand.
And all signs point to the fact that this was my old friend, I haven't seen him in a while. This was a broken relationship that led to, you know, them both being able to both basically driving each other insane. And so it's funny. It's ironic that we're talking about Chris, because I just saw it again, sort of in a guy that seems like a normal guy just goes off his rocker and ends up dead.
Yeah.
But like I said, I'm convinced that if Grunge was alive, they'd still be alive. And, you know, but you can't change
when
the way.
When I think of Grunge, just as we wind down here, I'm thinking about Pineapple Pete's.
Yeah.
What the hell was that place? It was the hotel where everybody stayed when we were doing worldwide tapings. And the name of the club, the bar, was called Pineapple Pete's. And, dude, everybody stayed there. It was like the dungeon in Atlanta, but this is in Kissimmee, Florida.
Yeah, I had another cheek plug. I had Jim Mitchell on my podcast, and he was talking about back in the Orlando days, and he was sort of, he lived in Orlando, yeah. So he was sort of the master of debauchery.
Yeah, the evil mayor. Yeah.
and yeah, it was a party for sure.
Going to 8 Tracks. Remember the name of the club? Everyone used to go there.
Yeah, and then there was another place that had a dance floor that that went in circles.
Yeah, but that was in downtown Disney.
Downtown Disney.
So yeah. We would go there and film for 2 weeks, and then go out every night. And there was like 150 guys there, and none of the office, like none of the top guys were there. It'd just be like all the John Nords and, like you said, like Chris Canyons and Jim Mitchells and all of us. Same with all the Armstrongs, you know, all those type of guys.
Benoit Dean.
Yeah, just going there and dancing all night on whatever it is that we were taking at the time.
And it wasn't like the tapings were the next night like normal. The tapings were like starting.
Morning.
We had to be up in the morning, so.
You would tape at 9, 11, 1, and 3.
Yeah.
And I remember one night I went out there, I got so loaded, and Terry Taylor was at the club, and he put me on at 9, 11, 1, and 3. You remember Bobby Eaton? He walked in and saw the poster of The Omen, because it was a 70s kind of, and he refused to walk out. Omen, scared of the Omen. He was scared of The Omen poster, and he was scared of La Parca, because without his mask, La Parca was so ugly.
He did you hear the story about him big leaguing me in Tijuana a couple months ago?
La Parca?
Yeah.
No.
I was in Tijuana with the wife and...
Just on vacation?
Yeah. And AAA was running. So I called Conan and texted Conan and said, hey, you know, I see you running. And he said, come down and be my guest. And so I went down there and... And I saw Hoovy, Big Hug. I saw even the guys from TNA that had been there for a cup of coffee, you know, Hector Garza and stuff, you know, gave me, you know, hey, great to see you, Psychosis, like Big Hug. I went up to La Parca and he totally blew me off. And I'm like, you remember me, right? The ring announcer is like, yeah. And just kept on his conversation. And there is a story behind that. But I'm waiting for you have maybe more power to get Conan on your podcast to tell the story. Yeah, I've had him on mine, but not he hasn't been able to. He's been so busy with MLW and TNA and Impact and AAA. But he got the true story behind it, and I don't want to give it away. But actually, the funny part is I really at the time kind of didn't think he was big leaguing me. I kind of just thought he was like busy or whatever. But he was. He purposely big leagued me. And it wasn't me that did something. He was taking something else out on me because he just associated all gringos as being rude. But I'll let Conan tell the story.
Do you enjoy? Well, ask him a question. I'll ask this one first. Do you miss being around the business?
Yeah, well, I do the podcast and I get to be around a little bit.
That's cool. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I get to do that StarCast thing.
So you still get gigs to do stuff? Yeah.
Every once in a while. And, you know, work with the Legends of Wrestling. Remember that big show in Shea Stadium a couple years ago?
Yeah,
we do different football stadiums. Brian Knobbs runs that, believe it or not. And Brian Knobbs is sober, believe it or not.
Wow.
So... Yeah, so I still get to dabble around in it and all that, but yeah, I'm
tell us about your podcast. I was looking at the rundown. You've had a lot of pretty big guests on it. There's a couple on there that I haven't even had yet. I'm like, geez, Spencer's doing good.
Do you have Terry Funk?
I have not had Terry yet.
Yeah, I had Terry Funk. Yeah. It's called Sitting Ringside with David Penzer. Somebody said, hey, you should do a podcast because I was on a couple people's podcasts and I had no idea what a podcast was. I knew you did one, but other than that, I didn't really know. And Steve Austin did one. And so there's a company down here called Radio Influence, a couple of program directors for sports talk local here in Tampa, and they're a national company, and found them and we hooked up, and basically we just tell stories, you know, just sort of like it's sort of like what we're doing. If you were on Sitting Ringside, it would be the same conversation, only I'd be leading right. The conversation, and it's available Chops First every Monday morning on all podcast platforms. And
who's been your favorite guests?
Oh Jesus, that's hard. Probably Scott Hall. But I mean, you know, we've had Terry Funk, Dory Funk Jr. We've had, I mean, and some of the ones that I did that you wouldn't think. I mean, Jim Mitchell was fantastic. Rip Rogers was hilarious.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
We actually do every 3 or 4 month segment with Rip Rogers, politically incorrect with Rip Rogers.
Oh, he's so nuts.
Oh, but so, you know, the ironic part is the ones that you think might be tough sometimes pulling, you know, stories out are the ones that go on for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the ones that you think would go on for 2 hours, they don't go. So, you know, more name buddy. But yeah, if anybody wants to check it out, they can follow me at David Penzer on Twitter. And I wanted to remind you of one thing. I don't know if you remember this. We were in West Virginia at a bar, and I can't remember the name of the bar. I actually had a client I sold a house to in Tarpon Springs that was from West Virginia that knew the name of the bar and used to go there. But you did karaoke. I don't know if you remember this. You got up and you did karaoke at the bar, and I was shocked. And I looked at you and said, "Holy crap, you could freaking sing. You should start a band." And I'm not saying that's the reason Fozzie was founded. I'm not trying to take credit for it, but I'm thinking maybe I might have put the idea in the back of your head that became what it is now, and your great success. So I don't know if you remembered that, but I'll never forget it.
I don't remember that, but
do you remember the bar?
No, dude, how many bars did we get?
I know, but this one was really fun, and they would comp us everything. And
dude, they were all fun and comp us everything.
See, I forget you kept going. See, I stopped in 2001 and had a, you know, I'd go on a tour here and a tour there, and I forget you've been going for all this time.
Last question, if you're thinking about WCW, what was like, is there a moment, like your favorite match or your favorite Nitro moment that you were involved in or got to see where you went, oh my gosh?
I always say two moments. The first one was when Scott Hall walked down the steps in Macon, Georgia, and got in the ring and we knew he was coming. It wasn't a surprise.
Yeah.
But what we didn't know is that they were, you know, going to play off the whole Scheme Gene,
right,
you know, thing that WWF had been doing at the time. And then, you know, you want a war, you got a war. A light bulb went in my head and just thought that was incredibly, and I just knew something special happened that night. The other one was in, I don't know if you're still with the company, in Greenville, South Carolina, the reunion of the Horsemen.
Yeah. That's when Flair came back after Bischoff fired him.
And I helped, and the reason it's sort of special to me is I helped Arn work on that speech. He worked on it for weeks when we were driving down the road together, and he would throw things off me, and I knew the speech like word for word. You know, even down to the, he hit himself and said, "I have Alzheimer's. Ladies and gentlemen, Rick, almost forgot Rick Flair." And then Rick came down and they did the shoot thing with Eric going, you know, "Fire me. I'm already fired." You know, but just my being a Horseman fan and being somebody that rode with Rick and Arn and was very tight with Arn, and also Dean and Chris, who were part of that group. That was another moment that I'll never forget. Those two, I don't know that I could pick one more than the other. And the other one would be probably Brett versus Benoit after Owen died.
Yeah, in Kansas City. Yeah. It's probably the best match Brett had in WCW. Last thing, are you familiar with our podcast that we do called Talk and Shop on Talk is Jericho? It's me and Gallows and Carl Anderson, and Gallows does...
Somebody played it for me at StarCast. Somebody came up to me and said, "Have you heard Luke Gallows?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" "Yeah, I know who the guy is." And he actually worked with us for Legends of Wrestling before he went back to WWE. And said, "He does an impression of you." And I said, "How come I've never heard of this?" So the guy pulls, it took like 10 minutes. I was getting like annoyed because I wanted to go back to my hotel. We were done for, I was walking out for the day. I was like getting annoyed at this poor guy. And he brought it up and I don't know that it sounds like me. But.
So I want you to end off the show by introducing Talk and Shop featuring Luke Gallows, however you want to do it. Coming down the ring, whatever, so I can play it for him and we can see which voice is better.
Ladies and gentlemen, making his way to the ring, representing Talkin' Shop, Luke Gallows. I'm glad that entertained you because I got no clue. Other than some guy at StarCast held his phone up and I got to hear.
Oh, dude, it's great talking to you, man.
Yeah.
We could do a whole lot more. And now that you've done my show, I will repay the favor.
Wow.
In about 3 years. Yeah, thanks, dude.
Sure.
All right, thanks to my old WCW traveling buddy, Dave Penzer. He's got a podcast as well right now. It's very successful. It's called Sitting Ringside. You can check out all the great guests at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Impact Wrestling's Scott D'Amore is his guest this week. And you know what else you should check out before it's too late? Talking about Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. We are 78% sold out. Cabins going fast. So book yours now. Come join us for the best vacation ever. Just ask anybody that went on the cruise last year. We had so much fun. Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea Part 2, the second wave, setting sail once again next year, January 20th to the 24th, 2020. Why is there so many 20s? Because this vacation is 20 times better than any other vacation you've ever had. And I want you to be there with us. And with AEW, All Elite Wrestling, the hottest wrestling company in the world today, is going to be there with all their top stars, including me. Fozzy is on board, ready to rock you. I'm really excited about that. Brad Williams is going to be the host. He was one of the stars of the cruise last year. Very funny comedian. I'm talking about Vicky Guerrero is this year's guest cruise director. Bruce Jingles will be doing some stand-up. He's hilarious. We also got Beyond the Darkness lined up to host some paranormal events on the ship. It was some crazy things that happened last year. And DDP will be there again, holding live DDP yoga workouts right on board on the top deck. How about this? Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, Sean Waltman are going to be there. The NWO, baby. How about Jake the Snake Roberts is going to be there? That's very, very cool to have him involved. Very excited about that. Also, proud to announce that Booker T, two-time WWE Hall of Famer, is going to be there along with Queen Charmel, the lovely Queen Charmel. She's always a blast. She is joining her her hubby on board. Charlotte Guerrero is going to be there joining her mom, Vicky. Also, we got Jared James Nichols, one of the greatest guitar players in the world today. We toured with him a few months ago. We had a great time. Farewell to Fear is going to be there. We toured with them as well. And the Dave Spivak Project. Actually, that was the whole Canadian tour. I liked it so much, I put it together again. A little bit of Canadian blues rock from Dave Spivak. The greatest 80s cover band you'll ever hear in the world today, Rubik's Cube, is going to be there. And that's just the beginning. We've got so many more to be announced later this week. A few more huge, huge stars. You're not going to believe it. Come book your cabin now at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Don't miss out. This will be one of the greatest vacations of a lifetime. You're going to have so much fun. And speaking of fun, come check out Fozzy. We've got a quick little tour in May, doing a little bit of a run May 15th in Greenville, South Carolina at the Firmament with Talk Is Jericho alumni. Anita Strauss is going to be joining us on that. Also, she'll be there on May 16th, Greensboro, North Carolina at Cone Denim. Greensboro, like I said. Then we go May 17th, Virginia Beach at the Lunatic Luau in Virginia. We played that a couple years ago. May 18th at the MMR Barbecue in Camden, New Jersey at the BB&T Pavilion. What a great place that is. We played there last year for another station. This year is for the great WMMR in Philly. July 12th will be in Mansfield, Ohio in Incarceration. August 3rd, we're doing a radio festival in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. That's real. That's true. And how about this? September 14th, opening for Iron Maiden at the Bank of California Stadium in Los Angeles. Lots of stuff coming up for Fozzy. Lots of stuff coming up for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Lots of stuff coming up for AEW. Don't forget All Elite, Double or Nothing. Of course, May 25th at the sold-out MGM Grand Arena. And how about this? On Friday, returning to the paranormal, talking about the phenomena of remote viewing. Okay? Third Eye Spies is a documentary featuring pioneer Russell Targ. He pretty much invented remote viewing and discovered it in the early 70s. And producer Lance Mungia are going to be here talking all about this crazy phenomenon that's used by governments around the world, including the Russian government and the U.S. government. Lots of crazy stories about remote viewing. So close your eyes, drift away, and join me on Friday. Until then, stay hard, stay happy, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy! Coming to the ring, Dave Penzer! We'll see you on Friday.